Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world.
Ever.
Ever.
So, where are we going this time, Bob?
Eyes for the image. So, The Image, 1969 black and white short film directed by Michael Armstrong, starring Michael Byrne and David Bowie. And this was his first film role, wasn't it? And the film is one of the few short films ever to receive an X certificate, which is due to the violence in it.
Yeah.
And Bowie was paid £30 for a 3-day shoot in September 1967.
So, the plot, or what there is of it, so you've got a troubled artist, which is played by Michael Byrne, haunted by a ghostly young man, David Bowie, who appears to step right out of one of the artist's own paintings. No matter what he does, try and get rid of this image, it keeps coming back. Byrne even kills Bowie in the end, but it comes back to life immediately. So it's all sort of weird psychological horror. There's no dialogue in it, and it's black and white. It's just, which just adds to the creepy dislocation of it.
Yeah, and obviously Bowie's experience with Lindsay Kemp.
Yeah.
Absolutely invaluable for it. And on the back of the film script, it explains that it's a study in the illusionary reality world of the schizophrenic mind of the artist at his point in creativity.
That's what I thought.
That's what I thought when I saw it. So you can make up your own mind about it. You can watch it on YouTube. Yeah. It's 14 minutes long.
It won't take up too much of your time. So the story behind it and how it got made, it was made in the winter of 67. So 3 years earlier, Armstrong was at RADA and he was asked to write a screenplay by a fellow student called a guy called Tony May. He was looking for a short film to direct. Malam never made the film in the end.
No, and the screenplay was forgotten until Armstrong was offered the chance to make a short film for Border Films. And so these short films were basically used as programme fillers when distributed at double bills of foreign films. We're talking blue films, aren't we? We're talking sex films, aren't we?
So the idea being so that they could then cash in what was known as ED money, okay? The government's financial incentive to encourage British filmmaking.
See, I thought that was a typo, ED money. I thought it was supposed to be easy money, but anyway, and it probably wasn't that. But for the part of the boy, Armstrong cast a then completely unknown David Bowie, and he picked up a copy of Bowie's album in a London record shop, and he loved the wicked humour in it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, Bowie had recorded this album, and the popular misconception is nobody even bothered hearing it. But obviously, it did reach certain people, and they were smitten,
okay,
including Armstrong. So he's one of a small group of Bowie fans at the time, and he approached Bowie earlier to write the score for a film comedy based on Greek mythology called A Floral Tale. Bowie was also lined up to play the role of the Thracian singer Orpheus. It never got made.
Go figure. So John Finch actually was originally cast as the artist before he became famous, but he was already committed to another project. So Armstrong brought in Michael Byrne instead, and he also became well known for roles in A Bridge Too Far, Braveheart, Gangs of New York, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where he played the Nazi villain.
Yeah, that's right. There was a tiny, tiny production crew here. You got lighting cameraman Osama Rawi, went on to work on Zulu Dawn and Parting Shots, and Armstrong's close mate Martin Campbell worked on Edge of Darkness, GoldenEye and Mask of Zorro.
So yeah, the film was shot in black and white over 3 days, as we know, in an empty house just off the Harrow Road, and it was really, really cold throughout the shoot and really tough for Bowie. He had to spend hours hanging around outside, literally at one point hanging onto a window frame above an 8-foot drop in a basement, and they were also pouring water on him from a hose pipe just to signify rain.
Armstrong said later he was actually bright blue all over when he finally came back inside.
I bet he was, yeah. So one of the central plot features in the film is a painted portrait of David Bowie done by the artist William Mason. But afterwards, Armstrong gave the painting to Ken Pitt, who hung it in the hallway of his flat. And when Pitt left the building in 1983, It was sold at auction.
Oh, OK. So the soundtrack of the image was composed by Noel Janus, who's father of actress Samantha Janus.
OK. And so various delays meant that barely half of the screenplay actually ended up being filmed. But Armstrong asked Border Films to give him more money to finish it, and they said no. They just wouldn't do it.
Fair enough. Armstrong ended up having a big row with them over it, after which they took the film away from him and gave it to the in-house editor. This proved to be a complete disaster, not least because the edited film only ran for 7.5 minutes, which was half the minimum length required to qualify for Edie money.
For Edie, that's Edie, yeah. That's Edie for you to say, Bob. So they asked Armstrong back to fix it. Mm. This piece is longer than the film. Oh. He ended up expanding the film in a way that was greater than the original screenplay and managed to get it in at just under 15 minutes war. Never mind the quality field of it.
Screenplay, there's no dialogue.
That's a good point.
Obviously, Border were happy, didn't they? They got the Edie money. So Armstrong said later it was the first film to grow twice as long in the cutting room, and it was shown to trade with one of Border's foreign films, All Quiet on the Eastern Front.
Right, OK. And the image finally opened at the JC Cinema in Piccadilly Circus in 1969, sandwiched between two foreign sex films. You were right, Bob.
So we're skipping now. This is from your own collection. This is a copy of Sound. Great condition, by the way. Do you keep these very flat?
It's very tasty, mate.
So this is from April the 14th, 1973, and Bowie is a huge star at this point. And so, of course, you know, cinemas, well, the JC Cinema in Trafalgar Square start showing the image again. It's reviewed by Andrew Furnival, who devotes three entire paragraphs to it, but clearly doesn't like it. And he says here it's short, a banal 12-minute silent, perhaps 12 minutes? 14!
What?
Perhaps early Warhol plagiarism, who knows, made by Border Films at least 7 years ago, and then goes on to describe the plot, which there isn't much going on there, but it's just one of those things thrown out there because Bowie was famous and thought, what the hell, let's rescreen it.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, that's those things. I mean, I'm not sure that it came back to haunt him necessarily, but, you know, if you look at everything at that point in time was just flying around from David Bowie. The Laughing Gnome resurfaced, didn't it? You know, the world of David Bowie resurfaced. All of these things that had gone on in his past that nobody had noticed were now getting dragged out again because he was famous and people wanted to exploit it, understandably, probably.
Yeah, and anybody wondering what happened to Michael Armstrong later, he did make some other films like Mark of the Devil and The Haunted House of Horror with Richard Avalon, Richard O'Sullivan and Dennis Price.
Dennis Price, oh. One of the great horror actors.
And then he got into, naughty comedies, Mark. The Sex Thief, 1973, Eskimo Nell, both of which featured Armstrong himself, followed by Adventures of a Private Eye in 77. Apparently, he turned down, he opted out of doing Adventures of a Plumber's Mate and went back to horror instead.
The A to Z of David Bowie, with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
So I is for images.
It is, or to give it its full title, Images 1966 to 1967, brackets, anything we could find in the cupboard, close brackets. A compilation put together by Durham and Decca at the height of Bowie's popularity in the UK. And it's made up of the first solo LP and various singles and B-sides.
Yes, of course, you know, we've done this before. We're talking about the Anthony Newley influenced stuff that nobody was really interested in at the time, produced by Mike Vernon. A year after these songs were recorded, Durham dropped him.
Yeah, well, we've mentioned this, you know. So in the UK, Decca had already put out The World of David Bowie in 1970. And that was in the wake of Space Oddity.
Yeah.
Then reissued it in 1973 with the Ziggy cut.
Mm.
So it had had, you know, the curly cut and then the Ziggy cut.
Yeah.
Again, you know, all the confusion that we've talked about before. And they just wanted to exploit his material.
Absolutely. And, you know, and if you weren't wary enough, you'd probably pick that up and think it was current.
Yeah.
All right. In the States, though, none of the Durham songs have been reissued since he first came out in 67. So they packaged them all in a double album set, housed it in a great sort of cartoon comic panel sleeve on Decca's American label, London Records, in 73. And I'm looking across there, and there is your own copy of that, which still it looks pristine to me.
It's pretty nice condition, yeah. So it was designed by Neon Park, who'd also done Frank Zappa's Weasels Rip My Flesh,
yeah,
and Little Feat's Sailing Shoes and Dixie Chicken.
Yeah.
For those who don't know it, it is, I mean, it's a great cover, isn't it?
It's just really kind of wistful, isn't it?
It's so of its time, but each of the panels, it's a cartoon, it's a cartoon affair, and it's really sweet. But each of the different frames within it, they represent a different song. So you've got David Bowie there, where he looks like he's actually got nout on, but it does stop just below his belly button. But it's Sell Me a Coat that represents, and Bowie's outside. There is a four poster bed there with the sun and palm trees in the distance, but he's in the snow with snow on his shoulders, and probably with the wind blowing around a little bit like it is around our Arctic tent where we are here. And there's also the Laughing Gnome, which unsurprisingly features a gnome who's laughing.
Get away.
There is also, yeah, Did You Ever Have a Dream? For When I Live My Dream, yeah. We Are Hungry Men, Uncle Arthur. There is A Happy Land. Yes,
please, Mr. Gravedigger on the back, digging a grave.
Yeah. It's all there. Karma Man has got Buddha, you know. And he's great. Come Buy My Toys, Silly Boy Blue.
It's, yeah.
And Little Bombardier's got a rocket there with a couple of little toddlers around it.
Aww.
And what's on its head, I wouldn't like to say. But also at the bottom, you've got Valentino and Carmen Miranda.
Yeah.
Yeah, In the Heat of the Morning. I'm not sure how that relates to it. But, I mean, it's a great cover.
It
I
is.
Mean, there's another cover as well, which is the one here of David Bowie, released much later, and that's around the young American
style.
Yeah,
I was going to get onto that. So this is 75, isn't it? That one's reissued in the States with an up-to-date photo, then up-to-date of the young Americans with this big tie and acoustic guitar. I mean, I remember seeing that in the shop and thinking, what is this? It's just come out. Of course, you know, I was unwary. I realised it was the old stuff from a decade earlier.
Yeah, and then you go through it and then you realise exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But you buy it anyway. That's just the way it is.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
I is also for Eric Idle.
Eric Idle of Monty Python, most famously, and lots of other things as well. But do you know, Eric Idle does pop up every now and then in David Bowie's timeline. And I was wondering exactly what his relationship was with David Bowie. And I did some research, and it was quite hard to find anything. I asked Mark Adams, actually, from DavidBowie.com to help me out. And he did, bless him. What drew me in, actually, is the fact that Eric Idle is Duncan Jones's godfather.
Ah, okay.
So there was obviously a good relationship.
Yeah,
you know, and Bowie was a huge Monty Python fan. We know that much. He loved the Goons, and he loved Derek and Clive and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and Monty Python. And he said that everyone at Haddon Hall used to watch Monty Python, and they were in stitches.
Yeah, that's a great image, isn't it? All crowding around the TV set. There's also a great story in Kevin Kann's book about Bowie and Angie going to a gay club after a Spiders gig in Edinburgh in May '73, and they go in there, they get to their table that they'd reserved, and they find Graham Chapman from Monty Python and his partner sat there instead, and Angie said to him, "Do you know who we are?"
And he probably did, you know. So Python were doing the first farewell tour at that time, and Bowie was sharing the Post House Hotel with them, and Michael Palin complained about not being able to go to sleep because of the all-night party.
Okay. Other things about Eric Idle. Eric Idle and Bowie went on holiday once with Iggy Pop, possibly.
Right, okay.
2 days before Bowie passed away, Eric Idle tweeted, "Happy birthday to the three kings, Elvis, David Bowie and Graham Chapman."
Yeah, and this is a quote from John Cleese. He said, "I remember coming back home once when Monty Python were on tour. I think we'd just been in Newcastle. And the next morning, Eric said, I went out to a dinner party and David Bowie was there. He was really excited. But if someone had said to me, want to come and meet David Bowie, I would have just thought, why?" He seemed like a deeply unimpressed man on lots of occasions.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is from Eric Idle's blog here, which is called The Needy Bastard Diary. And he says, "I remember something Robin Williams did to a persistent heckler the night I first met him in London in 1980. I got the entire audience to pray for the death of this unfortunate man. Thank you, Robin. And it makes a nice change, me taking your jokes. All right, bitter, posthumous kidding. And I never minded him using my material at all because he always took me on great holidays. And I had no other outlet for gags anyway back then. I remember saying to David Bowie once after a Robin show that I found it hilarious. You should," said David. "You said most of it at dinner."
Ooh, and this is again from the diaries of and the blog of Eric Idle. "January was a rotten month when I lost another friend. I've been thinking a lot about David Bowie. We shared a very unlikely friendship in the 80s and 90s with many great times on holiday. People don't know that he had the greatest sense of humour. He loved to laugh and he laughed loudly. And often."
Yeah, lovely. And another recollection here. He says, "In 1991, he was kind enough to loan me his beautiful Balinese home on the island of Mustique for a few weeks while I wrote a movie, which was Splitting Hairs. I can't begin to describe the beauties of this house or the amazing views perched high on a hillside overlooking the Caribbean. But this is a cheeky letter I wrote to thank him for our delicious stay." And it starts off addressed from Britannia Bay House, Mustique, West Indies, April 10th, 1991.
It's quite a long affair, which we won't go into, but this is a start of it. Says, "Dear David, just leaving the house. One or two things. The fire is nearly out. I think the hillside looks better, all bare and black, and Arnie agrees." And what follows on from there is just like a nonsensical description of supposedly Eric Idle and his mate just destroying David Bowie's house.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
So I is for... not only interviews, Bob, but important interviews.
Yeah, so of course, you know, Bowie gave many, many, many interviews over his career, some more important than others, some of the key ones. We're just going to have a quick look at. Obviously, there's a lot to go at here. Beginning, say, with Penny Valentine's piece in Disc, which came out in 11th of October 1969. And, you know, Space Oddity is there. So this is, he's a new kid on the block at this point. And she sets it up thus. She says David Bowie's 22 years old, thin, with a halo of fair hair, a delicately soft face, and two cold eyes. One's pale kitten blue and the other one green. That's not true.
No.
And it makes it rather disconcerting to talk to him. If he reminds you of anyone, it's a gentle mixture of Bob Dylan and Donovan. He says he sings like Dylan would have done if he'd been born in England. And he's an absolute charmer.
Yeah, she continues, Bowie was born in Brixton and now lives in Beckenham, Kent. His father, a delicate Yorkshireman, recently died. And his half-brother, whom Bowie considers a genius, is in hospital. So most of his tenderness is directed towards his mother, whom he takes to the studio on Top of the Pops to cheer
her
up.
Yeah, I know.
Never heard that.
Bowie says he had a very happy childhood. I was lonely, but I never wanted, and I never went hungry. I saw people deprived around me, and kids going to school with their shoes falling apart. And I suppose, yes, it did leave an impression on me that I wanted them to have better. I'm really a born idealist.
Right, OK. He does have material possessions, a small blue Fiat, and a house called Haddon Hall, which he and his affable young record producer, Tony Visconti, very nice, and their respective girlfriends are moving into soon. And he manages to live quite comfortably on about £12 a week, a sum he has consistently earned over the past 4 years.
Wow, okay.
He's not even afforded himself a rise.
No, not at all. She concludes by saying, David Bowie is a very difficult person to sum up, to arrange as a psychiatrist might in little sections of motive and result. But one thing is very, very certain. In the future, and this is very prescient here, in the future is going to mean much more to the world than just a name, an ex-mime actor or a leading inhabitant of Beckenham in Kent.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. This one being with Chris Welsh, and that's a melody maker, the 15th of November 1969, and it's a quote from Bowie. I run an arts lab, which is my chief occupation. It's in Beckenham, and I think it's the best in the country. There isn't one sued involved. All the people are real, like labourers or bank clerks.
Yeah, he said, we started our lab a few months ago with poets and artists who just came along. It's got bigger and bigger, and now we have our own light show and sculptures, etc. And he never knew there were so many sitar players in Beckenham. All right. I still don't consider myself a performer. I'm a writer. I really wouldn't like to make singing a full-time occupation.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's great looking through these things, isn't it?
It is.
Just seeing how he ducks and dives and turns and changes his mind.
Well,
and...
this has become more and more apparent. I mean, the next one's a great, very, very famous one, this one, isn't it? The Michael Watts one.
It is. Melody Maker, 21st of January, 1972, and the headline being, Oh, You Pretty Thing. And this is the most controversial one, and it's where Bowie declared himself to be bisexual, and Watts later said in his statement, changes the lifestyle of a generation and kick-started the LGBT movement. So Watts opens with, David Bowie, rock's swishiest outrage, a self-confessed lover of effeminate clothes, Bowie, who has hardly performed in public since his Space Oddity hit of 3 years ago, is coming back in super style.
Yeah.
Dangle that carrot.
Absolutely. He says, even though he wasn't wearing silken gowns right out of Liberties and his long blonde hair no longer fell waverly past his shoulders, David Bowie was looking yummy. He'd slipped into an elegant patterned type of combat suit, very tight around the legs, with the shirt unbuttoned to reveal a full expanse of white torso. The trousers were turned up at the calves to allow a better glimpse of a huge pair of red plastic shoes.
So sounds like, full... you know, bloody, what's that grey book called? 21 Shades of Grey or whatever?
50, isn't it?
Is it?
I think so.
I must have read the early edition.
David uses words like Varda and super quite a lot, writes Watts. He's gay, he says. The paradox is that he still has what he describes as a good relationship with his wife and his baby son, Zowie. He supposes he's what people call bisexual.
Right, okay, so it continues. David's present image is to come on like a swishy queen, a gorgeously effeminate boy. He's as camp as a row of tents. I'm gay, he says, and always have been, even when I was Davy Jones. But there's a slight jollity about how he says it, a secret smile at the corners of his mouth. I say to him, why aren't you wearing your girl's dress today? Oh dear, he replied, you must understand that it's not a woman's, it's a man's dress.
That was crucial.
Get him, Dave.
Yeah, Bowie also says, the important fact is I don't have to drag up. I want to go on like this for long after the fashion has finished. I'm just a cosmic yob, I suppose. I've always worn my own style of clothes. I change every day. I'm not outrageous. I'm David Bowie.
Right, OK. So from the same interview, Bowie is talking in an office at Gem Music, where his management operates. A tape machine is playing his next album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, which is about a fictitious pop group. They're releasing it shortly, even though Hunky Dory has only just come out.
How great. OK, he goes on to write, says his songs are always 10 years ahead of their time, says Bowie, but this year he's anticipated the trends. And this is a Bowie quote. I'm going to be huge, he says, and it's quite frightening in a way. He says, his big red boots stabbing the air in time to the music, because I know that when I reach my peak and it's time for me to be brought down, it will be with a bump.
Wow, so he's already like anticipating failing, just about on the cusp of breaking.
And he's also, you know, projecting Ziggy, even though Hunky Dory's just about to come out.
Well, we know that, don't we? Yeah. Was it a couple of weeks later after Hunky Dory was finished, he was plotting and recording Ziggy?
He was on it.
So Charles Shaw Murray from The Enemy, the 11th of August 1973. So he catches up with Bowie at the Chateau d'Ouville in Paris doing pin-ups, and Bowie's wearing some Ziggy Stardust old clothes. He says, remember the red pants with the tartan numerals and the 69 over the crotch? Out they come again with a purple velvet top and a delicious assortment of belts.
Never heard the phrase delicious assortment of belts before. Bowie talks about being a star in this interview. He says it's like a factory job. I think you have to be that serious about it if you intend to stay in. So he's making the distinction here between just a star and just a musician.
Yeah.
Okay. So you really have to believe in the phantom rock star myth. I'm only talking about a small number of people who have it. They're not stars, they're musicians, which is a different kettle of fish. Musicians are another breed of people altogether. I don't know very much about musicians at all or what makes them tick.
It's funny because my mum used to say, like, you know, when she was growing up, you'd have, like, film stars, and they were stars. Mm. Or you would have, like, you know, some of the big singing stars, like Frank Sinatra. But she said, everybody these days is a star. They're a soap star. She said, they're not, you know, if you're in Coronation Street, you're not a star, you're an actor.
Yeah.
It's almost like the same difference that Bowie's making here between being a musician and getting on with it and being somebody who is an icon.
Definitely.
So this one here is Cameron Crowe, Rolling Stone, May 1975. Strap yourselves in for this one. Crowe sets it up. It's 4 a.m, Hollywood time, and David Bowie is twitching with energy. He's fidgeting, jabbing a cigarette in and out of his pursed lips, bouncing lightly on a stool behind a control board in a makeshift demo studio, staring through the glass at Iggy Pop.
Did some demos for Iggy, okay. Bowie, this is the one where Bowie says, I've rocked my role. It's a boring dead end. There'll be no more rock and roll records or tours from me. The last thing I want to be is some useless fucking rock singer.
Okay, so Rolling Stone, June 1975.
So this is a series of notorious meetings with Cameron Crowe. And I think for the first time, really, in when you read through Bowie's interviews, like the ones we've just been in 72, they're quite manipulative in their way, aren't they? Because he's sort of like almost kind of beefing up his own legend. You get the idea that Bowie's orchestrating this stuff. But these interviews with Cameron Crowe, when Bowie wasn't in the best health, wasn't looking after himself, he lets the guard slip a few times here, doesn't he?
That's it, crucially. I mean, it's a lot of the time around here, it's the drugs talking, isn't it? Which he does recognise later on in his career, and we might well do in a moment. But yeah, June 1975. So we're looking at just a couple of months after the last interview with Cameron Crowe, who obviously had great access to him. I mean, Cameron Crowe, he had unrivaled access to Led Zeppelin all manner of bands, didn't he? He said, I could have been Hitler in England. Wouldn't have been hard. Concerts alone got so enormously frightening that even the papers were saying, this ain't rock music, this is bloody Hitler. Something must be done. And they were right. It was awesome. Actually, I wonder, I think I might have been a bloody good Hitler. I'd be an excellent dictator. Very eccentric and quite mad.
Yeah, a real famous one, that. Mm. I mean, in Playboy, writing in Playboy in September 76, Cameron Crowe starts to just realise he's accumulating these interviews now with Bowie. He said, my talks with Bowie began in early 75. Few of our sessions were marathon affairs. No matter how stimulating the conversation, after any longer than an hour of sitting still, Bowie could barely contain himself. Could we just have a short break? He'd blurt. Not waiting for a reply, he'd then shoot to his feet, dart in another direction, sometimes to write a song or two, other times to dash off a painting. In one instance, he ended a session by asking for a random list of 20 items. I gave it to him. He studied the list for 10 seconds, handed it back, and recited it from memory, backward and forward.
Wow!
It's ridiculous.
I've never heard that before. That's amazing. So, Cameron Crowe continues, he is fully aware that he is a sensational quote machine. The more shocking his revelation, from his homosexual encounters to his fascist leanings, the wider his grin. He knows exactly what interviewers consider good copy, and he gives them precisely that. The truth is probably inconsequential.
Yeah, you know, as we've mentioned, so Bowie, you get an idea of the state Bowie was in. He's saying, what year is it now? 76? He said, I suppose I've been knocking on heaven's door for about 11 years now with one sort of high or another. The only kinds of drugs I use, though, are ones that keep me working for longer periods of time.
Yeah, another quote, I have no message whatsoever. I really have nothing to say, no suggestions or advice, nothing. All I do is suggest some ideas that will keep people listening a bit longer. And out of it all, maybe they'll come up with a message and save me the work. My career has been kind of like that. I get away with murder.
Yeah, goes on to say, honestly, don't know where the real David Jones is. He said, it's like playing the shell game, except I've got so many shells, I've forgotten what the P looks like. I wouldn't know it if I found it. Being famous helps put off the problems of discovering yourself.
And Bowie continues, I'd love to enter politics. I will one day. I'd adore to be Prime Minister. And yes, I believe very strongly in fascism. People have always responded with greater efficiency under a regimental leadership.
And then some of the quotes that came back to haunt him in later years. Says Adolf Hitler was one of the first rock stars. Look at some of his films and see how he moved. I think he was quite as good as Mick Jagger. He said, I don't want to be Prime Minister of the old country. I'd have to create the state that I wish to live in first. I dream of one day buying companies and television stations, owning and controlling them.
It's strange. It's almost like the Newton character from The Man Who Fell to Earth, isn't it? He's just really, really bizarre.
And you're thinking, was he deliberately trying to sabotage his own career at this point? I mean, or was he just really spouting whatever just came into his head?
Yeah, I mean, he's probably doing it with a real sense of mischief and misjudging exactly what he's saying, because, you know, he did read an awful lot, didn't he, about fascism. And obviously, so it was all flying around his brain. And with the drugs taking over as well, he just like put two and two together and started perhaps to think it was a good idea, or at least wanted to ruffle feathers. And he ruffled feathers a lot with his sexuality and stuff. Sure. And nobody was interested in that anymore, were they? No. So maybe it was just a very ill-conceived way of, like, you know, making the splashes. Because we're mentioning these now, saying these are the most notorious interviews that he ever did. And he went back and I think he said, was it the phrase, I was out of my gourd?
Yeah, that's right.
You know? So we know that. But also, so Chris Charlesworth, Melody Maker, 13th of March 1976, and the interview took place in a hotel in Detroit. In his black tracksuit, he looked healthy, and although he could add a few pounds in weight, his brain is as trim as his figure. His hair, blonde at the front and red at the back, had been groomed by his personal hairdresser. It swept up in a quiff and held in place with water.
Not even styling gel.
No. Bowie says, I'm just doing this tour for the money. I've never earned any money before, but this time I'm going to make some. I think I deserve it. Don't you?
So this is Station to Station, of course, isn't it? He says, I've heard her look like a cabaret performer, but I've never even seen a cabaret performer, so I wouldn't know. The reaction is a lot better, and I guess that it's because I'm still giving them theatre. But whether they want that or not, I don't know. And I don't really care. The audience is about a tour behind me anyway, but then they always are. So there's like an arrogance going on here. It looks like he's adopting the kind of Thin White Duke character itself.
It's funny as well, because he says, I've never seen a cabaret character.
Yeah.
Or a cabaret performer. Mm. It's been recognised that some of the artists in cabaret influenced the way that he dressed.
Yeah.
And also some of the waiters who were in Berlin when he was living there Yeah, just pick the bones. Absolutely. It's just a funny one.
Yeah, and Judi Dench as well.
Yeah.
Theatre.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely. So Bowie says, I wanted to use a new kind of staging, and I think this staging will become one of the most important ever. It will affect every kind of rock and roll act from now on. I've reverted to pure Brechtian theatre, and I've never seen Brechtian theatre used like this since Jim Morrison and The Doors. And even then, Morrison never used white light like I do.
So he's not short on confidence here. Asked about his recent comments about right-wing politics, we just heard. Bowie says, oh, that was just bullshit, something I said off the cuff. Some paper wanted me to say something. I didn't have much to say, so I made things up, and they took it all in.
There you go. Okay, so job done. And Charlesworth even asked whether he's still bisexual. Oh, Lord, no. Positively not. That was just a lie. They gave me that image, so I stuck to it pretty well for a few years. I never adopted the stance. It was given to me. I've never done a bisexual action in my life, on stage, record, or anywhere else. I don't think I even had a gay following much. A few glitter queens, maybe.
Yeah, so again, Bowie kind of using stuff for his own ends, you know? There is one we'll just kind of touch on. Alan Jones, who he did for Melody Maker in October, 29th of October 1977. Bowie's in town in London to promote Heroes, and he's talking about, you know, he's kind of reflecting on his career a lot here. He said, I never intended to be so involved in rock and roll, and there I was in Los Angeles, right in the middle of it. I'm absolutely and totally vulnerable by environment, and environment and circumstances affect my writing tremendously, to the point of absurdity sometimes.
So Bowie says, my commitment has certainly never been in rock and roll. I've made no secret of that. I was just a hack painter who wanted to find a new medium to work in, frankly.
Yeah, he says, my role as an artist in rock is rather different to most. I encapsulate things very quickly in very short space of time, over 2 or 3 months usually. Generally, my policy has been that as soon as a system or process works, it's out of date. I move on to another area and another piece of time.
So reflecting on Ziggy, Bowie says, Ziggy was created out of a certain arrogance. At that time, I was young and full of life, and that seemed like a very positive artistic statement. Then that fucker wouldn't leave me alone for years. That was when it all started to turn sour, and it soured so quickly you wouldn't believe it. And it took me an awful long time to level out. My whole personality was affected. Again, I brought that upon myself. I thought I might as well take Ziggy to interviews as well. Why leave him on stage? Looking back, it was completely absurd.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's what the Spiders said as well, wasn't it? They just said that Ziggy just took him over.
Yeah.
He wouldn't travel with the rest of the band. He was this iconic rock star, which he was anyway, and doomed to failure, which Bowie already had the downfall plotted in his mind.
And he found it easier to be Ziggy than himself at that point, you know?
Yeah.
It kind of served a purpose. Alan Jones, of course, you know, the fascist comments are haunting him already, 12 months on. Bowie sounds weary when he's asked about it. He said, I can't really clarify those statements I made. All I can say, I've made one or two glib theatrical observations on English society. The only thing I can now counter with is to state I am not a fascist. I'm apolitical. I guess it was all pretty glib, but then again, I'm not one for delicate social niceties. If I take a jump into the pool, I generally swallow all of the water.
That's a great quote that I've never heard anybody else use. But yeah, you can see he's taken a real U-turn on it completely, hasn't he? Unsurprisingly. I mean, you know, again, it wasn't helped by the fact that people were looking for it. And Bowie started it, and I mean, it was his fault. But then when he went to the was it Victoria train station?
Yes,
when he came back in 1976 for Wembley, and he did the wave from the open top car, and they caught his wave, you know, in a photograph.
Yes.
And if you're waving and you're caught halfway through the wave, it looks like a fascist salute, which they were gonna jump on, given the fuel that they've been given by Bowie himself.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley, and recorded and edited by Howard Knock. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode,
Joe Bryath,
John Lennon,
John Peel.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.